Welcome to the Sleepy Cues podcast, where Linda Schmulowitz
and Jessica Sawicki will share answers to all your questions related to your children's sleep and parenting of young children. We are both certified gentle sleep coaches.
Thanks for tuning in to hear the answers to the many questions that come up with the families we work with.
Hi, welcome to the Sleepy Cues podcast. My name is Jessica Sawicki. I have my co-host Linda Schmulowitz with me here. We also have a special guest with us today, Evelyn Mendel. She's a licensed mental health therapist from Hatch and Bloom. Welcome, Evelyn. I'm so happy you're here with us today.
Thank you for having me, guys. Excited to be here.
Today, Linda and I want to just pick your brain about your specialty and really focus on toddlers, because Linda and I really work with a lot of clients ages 0 to 10 years old, but the toddlers are the really tricky ones, and we really want to hear all of your expertise. But first, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, you know, the work you do with your families and all of that.
Sure. So as Jess said, I'm a licensed mental health therapist. I primarily work with parents now, actually. I used to work with kids for a while in private practice, and then I transitioned to really working with parents. I find it to be even more effective to go straight to the source, right? The ones who can make the greatest change, I think, in their kids' lives. I believe parents are really an enormous agent of change in a child's life. So I really work with parents one-on-one to empower them with the information that they need to know about development, about the stage their child is in, maybe the type of temperament their child is in, and then trying to give them good strategies that would meet the needs of their kids. So I do one-on-one sessions. I do workshops and webinars. I've done workshops with Jess in the past. For example, I like to collaborate. I also have a training and a certification in something called infant mental health. So I really focus also very much on the early years. So really 0 to 3, but I really do like 0 to 6, 7. And then I get the parents of the older ones. They'll call me and I'll still take them. I also have a podcast, and that's it. I'm here to chat with you guys about all things toddlers.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I'm so excited that we're talking about toddlers because, as you know, since you work with a lot of parents of toddlers, they're the ones that are really feeling kind of desperate because this is such a difficult stage. And I always say to all of my families with toddlers, just to reassure them, I feel like toddlerhood is the hardest stage of parenting. You know, in the beginning, it's a lot about just management. You have a baby, you're like, okay, we just need to figure out how to keep you alive. But now this is where parenting really happens. And I tell my families all the time, I live with 2 teenagers and I would not go back to toddlerhood for all of the money in the world.
I was just going to ask you, teenage years or toddler years? I don't know which one's
up. Yeah. I really like the adolescent years, especially compared to toddlerhood. It's so hard.
Yeah. And there's people that would disagree with you. That's pretty impressive about the teenagers. You know what's interesting? There's a big parallel happening in the brain development when you look at toddler brains and when you look at teenage brains. So it's interesting you say that because both those stages of development have lots and lots and lots of stuff going on. There's a lot of pruning. There's a lot of wiring and rewiring. So you're actually seeing like pretty big parallels in both of those ages, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. So actually, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about what exactly is happening in a toddler brain. And what about that, I think, makes it such a difficult stage for parents.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, there's so much happening in a toddler brain, but I'm going to just cover probably the main things that parents are seeing. So let me backtrack a second. Every stage of young child's life kind of has a developmental job. And when you look at infancy, for example, like their developmental job is really to gain trust. It's like, I need to trust somebody to take care of me, to keep me alive. And so they gain trust in their caregiver and they move on to the next developmental job. In toddlerhood, their job is actually, as you can probably imagine, independence, right? It's autonomy. So there's like this really big drive for the emerging toddler and the toddler to really find their own independence, want to do things by themselves, want to assert themselves, this really big drive happening in the brain. And at the same time, there's also not that much capacity and capability for them to do things on their own, right? Or to make great choices or safe choices, for example. So you definitely have that going on in the brain. You also have really, really big feelings happening with a lot less capability for regulation, self-control, impulse control. So I think just all of that combined creates a really kind of tricky to manage person in front of you. And this is why also toddlers are super irrational. They're not rational beings. They really aren't. Half the time they don't even know what they want, right? So like the typical scenario you hear about is they ask you for the blue cup, you give them the blue cup, they're mad at you for giving them the blue cup. Why did you give me the blue cup, right? It's not even about the cup, right? Like there's so much just going on in their little body and their little brain. And a lot of it is about power and about autonomy. And also a lot of it, toddlers still don't realize that when they make a choice about something, it means they're giving up something else. And that's really interesting too, because sometimes you're like, okay, well, my toddler chose this, but they don't realize that means that the other thing can't happen at the same time as well. So see, if we don't know all of this, we kind of just look at the little person in front of us and we're like, oh my gosh, they're just out to get me, right?
Mm-hmm. They're monsters.
Right. And that's actually why I find toddlerhood harder, because you can't really hold them accountable for their behavior. Mm-hmm. Whereas with teenagers, you can be like, hey, you know, let's talk about this. What were you thinking? And then they can reflect on it. With toddlers, there's no rationality to it.
No, especially when they're in the heat of the moment. Like, I think that one of the biggest parenting mistakes that I see often is parents reasoning with an unreasonable toddler. Like that just is not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, no.
I see it on the streets and I just want to stop it all the time. I'm like, just save your words.
Right.
It's not going to go anywhere.
I always say to parents, you cannot talk your toddler into going to sleep. Like they think that they can. They think like, oh, well, you can respond back to me. You're a walking, talking person, but you cannot convince them that that's something that they want to do.
Right.
And so when you get into that loop, there's very no hard point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always say they're like negotiating with terrorists. Like it's just, you're just negotiating. And unfortunately, like it's just not going to go anywhere. So yeah. What are the most common toddler parenting concerns that parents come to you with? What do you hear a lot about?
Probably the top two or three would be power struggles. I think that's number one, power struggles. The parent telling the toddler that they need to do something and the toddler saying no or not doing it, not complying, or the toddler asking for something like, I want an entire box of Oreos for lunch, and the parent saying no. And then also impulsive, aggressive behaviors that come from dysregulation. So like hitting, throwing things, pushing, biting, screaming, tantrums. Tantrums are really big too. So I would say those are probably the biggest, the reasons that the parents come to me.
And so toddlers are sort of known for their stubbornness. I always say persistence is actually what it is, and persistence is a positive quality in human beings. Yeah. But it's really hard when that person who's so persistent is small and irrational. So what do you say to parents of toddlers who describe their toddler as being the most persistent person on the planet? Like they don't give up ever.
Well, first, I would congratulate that parent for using the word persistence, because I want to say 99% don't use that word. They actually will use the word stubborn. They're really stubborn. They don't care about anybody else's opinions and feelings. And so the fact that they could reframe that hopefully to something more positive, which is persistence, which is what it is. It's like this determination. I would say that it's a great quality to have and a very annoying quality to parent. So being able to separate that. So knowing this is good for them, it is good for their development, it is healthy, it is not something that we want to crush and take away from our kid, but it is something that we want to help navigate and manage. All toddlers, I think, are pretty determined, but there's definitely differences in temperament. So you have ones that are much more strong-willed, and you have others that you kind of lay the law of land and they're like, okay, this is how things work, and they move on. So for the ones that are very strong-willed, I would say a couple things. I would say definitely giving them choices, giving them moments in the day to be autonomous, maybe not in everything. So they don't really get to choose when bedtime is, but maybe they get to choose how they want to get to bedtime, how they want to get to their room. Do they want to play on the way there? Lots of little moments of power where it's not really interfering in your daily routine. You're just giving them small, small choices in how you do something. And the other thing that I would say is consistency. These kids require lots and lots of consistency. They are not as easily convinced as kids who are less strong-willed, who, again, you might just kind of say, this is how it's going to work from now on. It might be two or three times, and that child might be like, okay. Whereas the very persistent ones are, nope, they're not easily convinced. So they need to make sure that there's no way around this. So they will test and test and push and push and push and push. And that might mean one day a behavior gets a lot worse, the screaming gets louder, they start getting more destructive or whatever it is. But if we're always changing our responses to the child, they're not really understanding cause and effect as well. So work with the quality you have in providing them opportunities to really show their power. Persistence is great in things like when they're determined to build something or learn a new skill. Like, that's where it's really great and you want to encourage. And then at the same time, you're still the leader. You're still the one in charge. You've got to let them know things aren't going to only go their way as well, with consistency.
I think of my 5-year-old daughter, who is very persistent, and all her qualities are great qualities. As she gets older, it just makes parenting very hard. So she's very persistent. She knows what she wants. She doesn't let people tell her otherwise, which is what I want in my daughter, a strong, independent woman. But as a 5-year-old, it's extremely hard. And you're saying about choices. And just yesterday, we were in the car driving and it was like 5 o'clock and we had to get home. I knew she had to do homework. And I knew at one point she'd take a bath and dinner and go to sleep. And so I actually said, all right, Mila, when we get home, what's the order that you want to do the next 2 hours? Do you want to get home and do homework first? Do you want to do this? And so she's like, but I don't want to do homework. I'm like, okay, that is not a choice, but we can choose when you do homework from now until then. So she got to choose her order and we did it in her order. Might not have been the order that I wanted, but she did it in her order. And that was making the last 3 hours of the day a lot easier, especially since I had to be alone with the 4 kids and the home management, and it made it a lot easier for her. So giving her that was helpful.
100%. That's what I mean about almost inviting them to help you figure out how to do something. And I think even that makes them feel important and like a contributing member to their family as well. I have a very similar experience to share with my daughter where it was the same thing, Jess. Our morning routines were not great for getting to school. She was probably 4 at the time. And she wanted to do something in an order that made no logical sense to me. I'm like, why are you going to your room, back to the living room, back to your room, you know, all this stuff. But she was like, well, this is what would make me feel good. And I said, okay, if you can show me that you can make this happen and this will work for you, then fine. And again, I wouldn't have like maybe a 1.5 year, a 2-year-old choose something like this. She was definitely older. And now it's been, I think, 3 years and she still does things in like the most awkward order ever, but it works and we're out the door on time. Right. So sometimes I do think it's letting go a little bit of like our expectations of exactly the way that things need to get done and leaving room for trial and error for other things as well.
Like when I have my 2 teenage boys walking out of the house with their shoes in their hands and the backpack opening. Okay, hopefully you get those shoes on and the homework doesn't fall out, but if it does, it's your fault. Anyways, choices of very good tool and tip for parents. Are there any other tips that you have for parents that you find that will be helpful for our listeners?
Yes. So I have 2 other tips for you I want to share besides choices. And by the way, I want to go back to choices a minute, because choices is not only like, do you want to choose, you know, this hat or this hat? Choices are also the way that I actually present a consequence. So it's like you can choose to eat your dinner or you can choose to be all done. Like, we're not having Oreos. So if you don't want to eat your dinner that's in front of you, you're choosing for your dinner time to be over and I'm not giving you more things. But again, it's almost like a threat masked in a different way where they are more empowered. But also what I really like is they're much more accountable in that way, because at the end of the day, they are the ones making their choice. I think it takes a bit for a toddler to really understand this cause and effect kind of process. So you don't have to only use your choices as which snack do you want. But again, it's either we use the toy in a safe way or you're choosing to put away your toy for now. So that would be the consequence. So instead of saying either you play it right or I take it away, right? So you see how the difference is there. two other things I want to mention. One is I think visual charts are so helpful for toddlers for many reasons. One is obviously just the reason of them being able to see the order of what's coming next in front of them. That gives them predictability, that makes them feel a lot more in control. And the second reason for that is we almost remove ourselves from micromanaging every single thing that our toddler needs to do. And we're just telling them to do things all day. So we just refer back to the chart. We see what's next. We see what they already got done. And so it's kind of like, well, this is what's next on the chart. It kind of removes the power struggle a little bit because it's not like you just micromanaging them and helicoptering them. And the second thing I would say is I find also that very often parents will give toddlers like a very vague sort of directive, like it's time to get ready or it's time to clean up or it's bedtime. And those are really big goals or steps. So what I would say to that is breaking down a directive into much, much, much more specific smaller steps is much more likely going to get your toddler to cooperate. So instead of, for example, the cleanup example, instead of just saying cleanup time and then ending it there, you can say it's time to clean up. Blocks go in the bin, crayons go in the box. Same with bedtime, right? So it's not just it's bedtime and that's the only thing you say. You're actually going to go into what the next steps are. What are they to expect? And that's where you can also throw in sort of a choice. So we've got to do this and then this, or like what Jess, with the example you gave, like which one do you want to do first? So breaking things down into smaller steps. I don't think giving them too many steps at a time. We have to also know developmentally, they can't follow five instructions at a time. So being able to keep it manageable, and as they sort of complete a task, you move on to the next one. So those are the three tips I have for you.
It sort of reminds me of like when parents say, I need you to sleep through the night. And kids are like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know? And so that's where, when we are talking to families, we say like, okay, we need you to lay quietly in bed, keep your body in bed, follow what your light says, like very specific rules.
100%. I hear this all the time when parents will say like, I need you to behave. Like, what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Such a generic and subjective term at the same time. So what does that mean? Does that mean they need to use more quiet voices? Does that mean they need to keep their hands to themselves? Does that mean they need to sit and wait? Like, we have to be much, much more specific with these little beings.
Oh yeah. Man, I'm guilty of that then, because I'm constantly telling my five-year-old, you need to behave.
I think you can just start it like that, but then like break down what your expectations are. Because again, for her, behaving could just be like, I didn't slap my brother across the face. And for you, it might mean something totally different. So I think when we clarify expectations, it helps them cooperate more too.
I'm definitely going to work on that then.
I think the other piece also with choices though, is when you give them a choice that's really a consequence, then you have to be willing to follow through with that.
Yep.
And so if you say, you know, you either eat the meal that we made or dinner's over, then you have to follow through with not being like, okay, fine, I'm going to give you this little snack, you know, even though you didn't really want your dinner and I said dinner was over. That's where then they don't take you seriously.
Yes, yes. And this is a big problem. Like, this is where I ask parents to think very, very, very carefully about the consequences they are going to offer. And also, sometimes the consequences are more of a punishment for the parent.
Like no screen time.
No screen time, or we're not leaving the house today, right? Like then, okay. So think about what you're going to tell your kid and only please tell them something that you can really, really follow through with and be okay with. They, at this age, are so perceptive to cause and effect. You lose credibility really, really quickly when you cannot back up your word. So really think about the choices you're going to give them.
Linda, I don't know if you remember me telling you this story, but there was one time Milo was refusing to cooperate at bedtime. And so my husband was like, if you continue doing this, there's no more books and you're going straight to bed. Well, guess what? She was placed into the crib, shades open. I think she was still like in clothes. He kept on giving her threats and he came down. And I'm like, where's Milo? He's like, she's in her crib. I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, I had to follow through. Mm-hmm. I told her that if she wasn't going to X, Y, and Z, she had to go to sleep. And lo and behold, she was in the crib.
At like 3 p.m.
No, it was regular bedtime. So it was not so bad. And then I went in, shades were open. The girl is persistent, but she ended up falling asleep in, maybe she was in pajamas, I'm not sure, but shades were open and she was sleeping because he had to follow through. And he's like, you always told me I have to follow through. And I'm like, I guess you're right. But it's she was true. In there.
There's like so much guilt around your child going to bed hungry. It's something that is so hard for moms. I also know that your kid will be okay. They're not going to starve. I promise they're not going to starve if one day they are protesting. But if you just are like, let's go down and get a snack. And then not only are you giving them a snack, you're giving them something that is much more reinforcing. Like suddenly they get to eat pretzels and chips and all this stuff. Of course, they're going to refuse dinner for the next 3 days. So be very wary of that as well.
Yeah, the number of conversations I have with parents where I say, just because your toddler didn't eat dinner doesn't mean that right at the moment where you're about to tuck them in, suddenly they're starving.
Yeah, it's just such a delay tactic. It's a genius one because it pulls at the mom's heartstrings.
Brilliant. Yeah. And they know that that's like, oh, I can't put you to bed hungry. And so that's where I have the conversation about how toddlers actually have very different eating habits than we have as adults. Yeah. They don't need the same amount of food that we do. They eat like one good meal every 72 hours.
I don't know if you've seen those Instagram accounts where they show you, I think it was Feeding Littles or something, where they show you like what you think your toddler needs to have on a plate and what they actually need to have on a plate. And it's like 1/8 of the portion that you think. So I think just being able to inform yourselves about what your kid really actually needs is going to be a good start to that.
Yeah, I have a lot of those conversations. So what do you say to parents who will tell you, no, I've tried that. None of that works with my toddler. None of those techniques are effective. They just, you know, they just wait me out. They just scream until I can't take 2 hours of screaming anymore. So what do you say to those parents?
Look, it's hard to give like a full answer. Every family is different, but I could give you a couple of suggestions around there. One is, there's going to be a time, especially if you have a strong-willed toddler, who will answer you back like, I'm not choosing any of those things, or I don't want any of that, or I don't care. My policy on that is, if they don't choose, you choose for them. And I think it takes a bit of time for them to understand what that really means. But if you consistently tell them, when you don't make a choice, I choose for you, and then you choose for them, eventually they realize that they completely lose out if they don't choose. So it takes a bit of time, especially for the strong-willed ones, but eventually they will get that it's better for them to make a choice than for you to make the choice for them. And the second thing I would say is, you're not just only giving them a choice and that's it. You're helping them with emotion regulation. You're helping them to calm down because they are so irrational in these moments. So honestly, if I have a toddler in front of me with very heightened emotions, I wouldn't even be giving them choices in that moment. My number one strategy first would actually be to try and co-regulate this child to get them to a space where they are calmer. And because what happens, going back to what I didn't say about the toddler brain or any of the little kids' brains are, is when they are very much in their emotional brain, their logical brain is completely, completely shut. Their lights are out. So what you want to do is get them to a place where they're calm enough, where that little glimmer of reason kind of opens back up. And this is where we actually can problem solve or make choices or go on. But when they're not there, you actually want to do less talking, more of physical regulation, or even if it means we're in a place that's really stimulating, I would almost walk outside with my toddler. I would have them have the meltdown in a safe space. I would even tell them, I'm picking you up. We're going outside in a safe place where you can have your feelings and I'm right here, whatever it is that needs to happen that way. But these aren't moments where I'm going to be having conversations with my child. These are moments where I'm just going to be helping them ride the wave of that emotion. Obviously, boundaries need to happen if that toddler is now hitting or pushing or running into the street. So it's a really big combination of a lot of things.
Yeah, for sure. That actually reminded me of another question, which is, do you have some good language for parents to use when their kids are using physical aggression? Because I know that's where we start talking. And
so. Yeah. So I like to keep it really simple when it comes to that. So what I like to tell parents to start telling their kids, literally as long as early as babies, is their job as a parent is to keep them safe and healthy. When something's not safe or healthy, it is my job to make it safe and healthy again. Almost any boundary can actually be tied to one of those two things. So hitting, aggression, any of that is not safe. So when that happens, the language that I really like to use, rather than hands are not for hitting or we don't hit, that feels a little more permissive to me. I really like, I can't, or I won't let you. Like, you're blocking their behavior. You're not actually allowing them to just continue hitting you or continue hitting their sibling or even hurting themselves. There's kids that hurt themselves. So hitting your head on the floor is not safe. I'm going to hold you now until we're calmer so we can be safe again, kind of thing. So very short, it's I won't let you or I can't let you. And then you're actually going straight into action, which is some sort of blocking or helping or carrying them or putting them down. Sometimes it's putting them down because sometimes you're carrying them and they're just whacking you on the face. You're not going to allow that to continue to happen. You're making sure you're showing them the boundary of also keeping your body safe. So I'm going to put you down because I'm keeping my body safe right now. So lots of language around safety and around I can or won't let you do these kinds of things that feels containing to the child. And that also feels like there's somebody really in charge of these behaviors and of keeping safety.
Thank you.
So Linda and I obviously work with a lot of kids to get them sleeping better and sleeping through the night and napping better. But a lot of with the toddlers, especially, we try to ease that bedtime process and getting that a little bit smoother. But a lot of times these kids throw these tantrums and they obviously are anticipating that whole separation and going to sleep. They don't want to go to sleep. So what strategies would you give these parents to help that bedtime process and that transitional process, or when they're throwing that tantrum at the end of the day that everyone is so dreading? Any tips or advice on that?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say is bedtime is, I mean, you guys know this more than anyone, but it's really complex because I feel like very often you have two very completely different agendas. Like the kid is trying to connect and be with you and stay up. And as they get older, especially, this is a time when the world is quiet around them. It's just them and you, and you're in bed. And this is where they're like, I want to tell you everything about my feelings and my life and everything, all my ideas. So you have that. And then you have the parent that's like ready to clock out. All right, I'm done being a parent for the day. And so I think that it clashes very often, those two agendas. And so it creates a very tense sort of bedtime for both. And then I'll leave you guys to that part. But what I'm trying to say is, I think understanding that where kids are coming from before you even start this process is going to be really helpful in being able to change your tune a little bit. I think very often, because parents are sort of like done with the day, this is where they get much more into harsh sergeant mode, like really sort of rushing it, really sort of forcing things, low patience, low threshold. And if we actually just invest a little bit more of connecting into whatever comes before, not even just bedtime, but even before, I almost want you to think about filling up their little love cup. I think before is going to be so helpful. So whether that means you're playing with them, whether that means you're doing lots of physical affection, cuddles and hugs, I think that they need to feel that love cup filled up before something like a separation for the rest of the night. Number one. Number two is, I'm going to say play is my answer for like 99% of things in parenting. I think it's so underutilized. You can use this in various ways. So if you're just sort of introducing the separation or you've moved to a bed or something like that, you can use play to play out scenarios with your kid. You can use doll play and truck play. You can use stories. For them, this is a safe world where they can see things happen and they still internalize these things, but it's in a safe, not vulnerable way because it's not them and they're controlling what's happening in the play. So that's such a useful tool to play out scenarios that they're living in real life. I wouldn't be, this is you, Max, and this is mommy. I would just keep it within the characters. And then they're able to kind of practice that. The second thing I would say is using play to transition. I love play to transition. So instead of this, we're getting into this really harsh tone. It's bedtime. Everybody needs to run to their room. I'm picking you up. We're going. If you guys can figure out a nicer way to get there. So it's bedtime. Do you think we should jump, go there like monkeys, or should we slither there like snakes? Something like that is going to help the kid transition a lot better too. And then the last thing with transitions too is transitional warnings. What a transitional warning is when parents are like, 2 more minutes, 5 more minutes. Toddlers don't know what that means. They don't know what that means. And sometimes they'll put a timer on their phone and then the alarm goes off. And still, a toddler does not know how to prep for that. So when I give parents advice for transitional warnings, I like to keep it relatable to what the child is doing. So if the child, for example, is playing a certain game or coloring, you might say, okay, it's our last 5 minutes. That means we're on our last color. We're going to draw our last circle, or we're playing with the trucks. It's time to find parking spaces for them. You've got to help them close out mentally the activity that they're doing in a way that makes sense to them. Think about you just working on a whole article for work and somebody just comes and shuts down your computer in the middle. That does not feel good, right? So if we give them, in the version of the employee at work, we give you time to finish up your sentence, to save your project, to turn it off, you're going to feel much better about that. And that's how it feels for a toddler when we can give them transitional warnings that they can relate to as well.
I think that's super helpful. So this is, I think, is going to be so helpful to so many of the families that we work with or other people who listen to this. Anything that we didn't touch on that you feel like would be helpful for people to hear?
Probably that this will pass. Yeah. This too shall pass, for real, for real. I know we say this, probably the most said phrase in parenting, but they won't be this irrational forever. I promise. They're just going through so much and so much awesome stuff is happening in their brain as well and in their bodies. You're going to see a shift. You're going to see them be able to tolerate frustration more and regulate themselves more and all of that. But right now, just know that they're struggling between trying to be independent, but also living in a world where they can't be so independent. So really just having compassion for them and for yourselves. Give yourselves grace, lots of grace and self-care.
I feel like when my son turned 1.5, I remember having the thought to myself, like, okay, 2.5 years, like, we just have to hold on. I literally thought that. And I don't know why I thought that like a switch was going to flip when he was 4. It's not like that was so much easier, but that was in my head. Like, we just got to get through and survive it. And then, you know, it's going to get easier. I don't know.
I mean, it gets different, right? Yeah. So the challenges are there, but they're different challenges. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, definitely. So how can our listeners find you and explain what's the kind of structure for how you work with families?
So families can find me on my website, hatchandbloom.co, or on Instagram. I'm there a lot. It's at hatchandbloomco. Clearly .com was taken. The structure that I use is I do mainly Zoom virtual calls, one-on-one sessions, or I'm constantly using topics like this and doing webinars online for parents. Sometimes I'll do corporate webinars. Sometimes I'll go to preschools. Like, if you guys have a preschool locally that you'd want me to come to, I mainly do workshops and one-on-one sessions. So you can just reach out to me there. I'm always putting parenting tips on Instagram as well, too. Cool.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Evelyn. This was super helpful as always. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.